Bound.
Welcome to Books and Beyond with Bound. I'm Tara Khandelwal.
And I'm Michelle DeCosta.
In this podcast, we talk to India's finest authors
and uncover the stories behind the best written book
and dissect how these books shape our lives and worldviews today.
So let's dive in.
This episode is part of our brand new series with Jeco Publishing House.
I'm so thrilled today to speak to Shatrujit Nath. He's an expert in alternative mythology. His love for alternate mythology is so much that he quit his career as a journalist to write fiction full-time. And we are going to be interviewing today about his series called The Warlord of Ayodhya. And that has just kept us hooked to our seats, because guess who is the protagonist? Who's the hero of this book? Ram? No, it's Bharat, who is Ram's half-brother. And it was such an exciting series because this is someone who has never been given the limelight before. We only hear stories of Bharat being a loyal brother, guilt-stricken after his mother sent Ram, who was the original heir on the throne, to exile so that Bharat could become the king. But we never really have done a deep dive into who he is, his character, his personality. So the book is about, you know, what happens when this untrained, unwilling Bharat becomes the king. And I absolutely love the characterization of this person.
Yeah. And what I loved is that he didn't just write one book about Bharat, but it's a whole volume. It's a whole series where there are three books about it. And today we are going to actually cover the first two, right? And this journey is not just superficial, because it focuses on Bharat being, you know, forced to take on this responsibility of a king, you know, while at the same time grieving his father Dashrath's death, right? It's not easy. And at the same time, he's such a dutiful brother that he mourns, you know, Ram's departure, because Ram is sent on exile. And he's faced with all of these strange things happening to the kingdom, you know, and now what's going to happen next?
Yeah, and there's magic, and there's the question of, you know, these, as Michelle said, strange forces attacking the kingdom. And the second book also tries to establish his legacy, because he has to make all of these risky decisions to face his enemies. So will he be able to overcome all these obstacles and protect his people? Let's find out.
Welcome.
Yeah. Hi there, everyone. Thanks, Tara. Thanks, Michelle, for having me over. It's certainly having me and Bharat over, I must say. Both of us are definitely looking forward to this conversation. I have a lot to say. Bharat has a lot to say. What Bharat has to say, I think he'll say through the books. And but thank you so much. Absolute pleasure being here.
Yes, we're really excited, you know, and before we deep dive into the book and, you know, your inspiration behind it, we actually wanted to know more about you. Could you please tell us a little bit about yourself? You know, what led you to Bharat? Because we've read that, you know, you've sold ice creams, you've written ad copy, you've worked as a journalist, you know, you've even been an assistant editor at the Economic Times. So how did this happen?
So, I'm a little bit of a rolling stone that, you know, never gathered any moss in that sense. So I've been kind of, whenever I meet youngsters who are kind of, you know, are very angsty about their future, and they tell me that, you know, I'm 22 and I'm 25 and I haven't really figured out what I want, I tell them, chill, it's okay. I figured out what I wanted to do at the age of 40. It's at 40 that I realized that I wanted to become a storyteller. So before that, I was probably just kind of in, you know, a prep zone, you know, advertising and journalism. Everything was kind of just preparing me, I guess, to bring me to the stage where I'm, you know, telling stories and enjoying doing what I'm doing. So it's writing is something that I've been doing for a long time. I've been writing, as you said, you know, I started in marketing. I used to sell ice creams, computer training courses, all of that. I figured that marketing was not my thing. Then I got into advertising. I was a copywriter for 2 years, 3 years perhaps. I realized that was not my thing. And then, of course, I got into journalism. And there, of course, I stuck around for about 10, 12 years. And then I realized maybe that's also not my thing. And then I've got now into writing fiction, and I've stuck around for 14 years. So I guess finally I found my thing. So yeah, very happy being here. That's who I am. The story of Bharat is just something that I was quite intrigued about. It just came out of a conversation that I and a friend of mine were having one fine afternoon sitting at his house. And I think we were talking about mythology, and I don't know, you know, who said what and how it's, you know, I don't remember how I arrived at Bharat, but I found it very fascinating. You know, it just suddenly dawned on me that, you know, when we talk of the Ramayana, we say that it's the story of four brothers. But actually, it's the story of only two brothers because it's only Ram and Lakshman. The camera always follows those two brothers, and it just completely forgets the other two till finally, after everything's over, Ram comes back and he becomes king, and the other two are just they're just there. And in particular, what I found fascinating about Bharat was that, the whole Ramayana happens because of him. I mean, it's because he's the inciting incident in that sense. I mean, KK wants her son to become king, which is why she, gets Ram to go into exile and Sita's kidnapping and Ravan and all of that. So if KK and Bharat hadn't wanted what they wanted, the Ramayana wouldn't have happened. So I found it quite fascinating that, it's this the story happens because of this guy, and we know practically nothing about him. And there's been so much that's been told about Ram and Lakshman and Sita. I thought it'd be interesting to look at a completely different character. And I thought, yes, I also love the idea of the designated survivor in that sense. In a way, Bharat is a designated survivor. He's 22. He's a young kid who's growing up in, Bharat never grew up in Ayodhya. He grew up in KKR, which was his mother's, maternal, kingdom or whatever it was. And one fine morning, Bharat is living a carefree life. And then one fine morning, he's told that your father is dead. Your elder brother, who was supposed to be king, has been sent into 14 years of exile. So you have to come to Ayodhya and become king. And he's like, what? And they say, yeah. And actually, this has all happened because of your mother. And the guy is like, he has no training. He has no ambitions. He's absolutely got nothing. He's actually got no skin in the game. And then he's brought to Ayodhya. As I said, he's never grown up in Ayodhya. So, he's a little distanced from the people of Ayodhya, who are already resentful of his, definitely resentful of his mother, are even suspicious that he might have had a hand in the exile of Ram and whatever has happened. How does this guy come to terms with all of this? How does he deal with the rejection of his people? How does he deal with what his mother has done? How does he deal with people who now realize that, there's a power vacuum in Ayodhya? And, everyone wants to capitalize on that. Enemies, friends, allies, everyone wants to, that's typically what happens when you have a power vacuum. And there are people constantly gaslighting him and telling him that you're not as good as your father and your brother. And what does this guy do? I thought it would be fascinating to look at this guy's arc and this guy's journey. So that's really what brought me to Ayodhya. I'm also very fascinated about his relationship with his mother, because I think that's a huge part of what happens through the 14 years. So I think that's really why Bharat.
Yeah, and I wanted to add that, it's not just the fact that you have written it. I really like that, right? And I also read a review online which says that, you've almost written him as if Shatrughna, who's his brother, would have written Bharat's story, which is like a lot with a lot of compassion and a lot of affection. And I think that makes all the difference.
Yes, I think you're right. And I in fact did tell a friend of mine once that, it's interesting that I've actually got a Shatrughna and a Yuddhajit in my story. So it's, there's Shatrujit is there through the two names I've got Shatrujit in. So yeah, I think so. I did want to come across, I did want to look at Bharat as someone who was forced into a position that he didn't ask for. And how does he, crawl out of it, claw out of it, and come out on top? That's really the kind of situation I was looking for. And I wanted to, yeah, it's definitely sympathetic, obviously. But not just for Bharat. I was also interested in looking at, so actually the series before Warlord of Ayodhya, I have done this Vikramaditya Veergatha series, which is a four book mytho fantasy. That's really fun adventure fantasy kind of stuff. I think what I'd done with that was I'd kept it very, very, it was very palace centric in that sense, that story. So I thought that maybe for a change, I do something where I bring in a lot of people who are not necessarily connected to the palace into this story. So, for example, you've got a palace investigator. Well, he's a palace investigator, but at the end of the day, he's an investigator. He's a common man. So I kind of brought him into the story. So he's one of the kind of secondary protagonists in the story. So I tried to do a little bit of that. Bring in characters who are probably not from the nobility royalty of Kosala, and try to look at it also from their points of view. How would they view what is happening? So I think that's really what I've tried to do with this series. Not just keep it about Bharat and Shatrughna, but also try and bring in that. Let's see. I don't know how well I have
Yeah.
succeeded in doing that, but.
Yeah, that's very fascinating. And I really like the questions that you're trying to answer, right? Like what happens in a power vacuum? And it's such a universal thing, no matter whether you're a Ayodhya or, a multinational corporation. power vacuum sort of cause these sort of like vultures and people trying to manipulate, and you brought that out really, really well. Do you have any brothers, since it's such a brotherly kind of narrative?
Yeah, actually, I do have brothers, but in fact, I'm the youngest of the lot, and they're both elder to me in that sense, and they're quite older to me. So, we've never had a so our relationship has been quite different in that sense. I mean, they've always treated me like a kid brother. So I'm obviously the youngest of the lot, and I have never actually had to face the kind of the insecurities that of comparison. And that's really, I think, what Bharat deals with a lot in this, and I think he deals with it even today, because Ram's shoes are so large. How do you fit those shoes? How do you fill those shoes? So I think that's really the challenge, and constantly being compared to somebody like Ram or somebody like Dashrath, who was also a king of great repute in his time. I think that's really, those are the kind of insecurities that Bharat has to deal with. And at one level, I think those are insecurities that are inside his own head, and probably not so, yeah, they're reinforced by others. But I think those are his insecurities, and he has to overcome them. It's only when, so his triumph is actually an internal triumph. It's only when he's able to get rid of those insecurities that he can actually come out and do what he's supposed to do. And I think there's a sequence in there's a scene in the second book where Mandavi, who's Bharat's wife, actually tells him that. She says that, you have to, you have to forget about Ram and Dashrath. You are an individual in your own right, and you have to kind of, she basically tells him that, look, I mean, you're so insecure that when I was expecting our son, you were not here. You were not in Ayodhya. You were in KKR. You're constantly running away from responsibility. You have to embrace that responsibility. And I think in that sense, she's a kind of a lodestar for him, in kind of giving him direction, all of that kind of stuff. So, yeah.
Yeah, and I really, the way that you've constructed Bharat, given that there's not much about him at all, we have so much about Ram, and there's really nothing about Bharat. So, a lot of the book is also fictionalized. It's your own imagination. There's elements of magic. It's really quite amazing how you managed to do that. So, in constructing this world of Ayodhya and constructing Bharat's world, firstly, how did you do the research and sort of, a lot of it is fictionalized. How much of it is also fact? What is the balance between the two?
Yeah, I think that's a very good question, for the simple reason that the answer is very simple. Most of it is fiction, because there really is so little on Bharat. I remember when I got this idea, I was obviously very excited. So I said, okay, now let me quickly dig and research and all of that stuff. I spent a good probably 5 months trying to just figure out what is Bharat's story. And there is practically nothing that's there, because Valmiki never wrote about Bharat. And because Valmiki never did, no one else really is ever bothered to flesh out that character in that sense. So it was both, it was a challenge, simply because there was practically nothing to go on. But it was also liberating, because it told me that I could take Bharat wherever I wanted to take him. I had complete free rein. So it was nice. So I think one of the things that I wanted to do with Bharat was that, our image, the mental image of Bharat, is the loyal brother who refuses to sit on the throne, and is just waits for his brother to come back. That's all I really had to go for. What I decided to do was, I said, okay, what does this man, and what is his, one of the things that happened early in the evolution of the plot was that I realized in the Ramayana, KKE becomes repentant of, or starts repenting her act of sending Ram into exile pretty early. I realized that if KKE does that, I start losing conflict. I also kind of found it strange that she would put her foot down and demand so much, and then just give it away because Bharat comes and tells her that, you did wrong. I thought that was kind of bizarre. I really think KK had thought through her decision very well. One of the interesting things that you might notice in the telling of my story is that there is no mantra. In the traditional telling of the Ramayana, it's mantra, the Dasi, KK's Dasi, who kind of instigates her to act against Dashrath and Ram, and demand that Bharat be made king. I again found it unsatisfactory that we kind of decide to lump all the blame on mantra. I think what it does most is it does KK a great disservice, Because KK, it takes agency away from KK. KK knew what she wanted. She wanted her son to be king. And I think that really is the bedrock of the conflict between her and Bharat. So, which is why I decided that KK is not repentant. And that allows me. So, KK is very clear. She says that you have to become king. And look, now Ram is not there. He's not coming back. Now you have to become king. But Bharat still refuses to do that. So I thought that that was a great, opportunity for me to play the friction between son and mother. I thought that was a good opportunity which I could play through the series. Of course, as one of the readers pointed out a couple of weeks ago, in 14 years, it's going to be difficult for you to sustain that conflict. And I also do realize as a writer that, they also have to reach a point of agreement. And I think that's really what book three is really going to be about. It's about how all these characters come together and all of that. But yes, definitely Bharat was, I wanted to explore Bharat as somebody who was not just a loyal brother. So in fact, people ask me what, have you named the first book? It's called Rebellion. Is it because, there's the rebellion against Bharat? I said, yes, but it's also Bharat's rebellion against his mother. That's actually what the real rebellion is. The other rebellion is the secondary one. It's this son rebelling against his mother and her idea that he be king. Same with resurrection, like people talk about resurrection and they think it's about the people who have disappeared, they're coming back and the resurrection of the. No, it's actually the resurrection of Bharat as well, because in book one, he just refuses to embrace that responsibility. But in book two, you can see he starts doing that. He's now realized that he doesn't have a choice. So it's Bharat's resurrection as well in that sense. Yeah, so I think that's really what Bharat is. And to answer quickly your point about magic. Yeah, I was actually very, very fascinated about, when we go back to our myths. And I remember there's this lady called Arshia Sattar. She's an expert on the Ramayana, like
Yeah,
she
we've
I have a
interviewed
good.
her. Yeah.
You have, is it? Okay,
Yes.
fantastic. Okay, so you know her, right? Arshia is brilliant. So I had the good fortune of knowing Arshia pretty well. So once I remember we were talking, and you read in mythology, you keep reading about the fact that, these asuras and rakshasas, they come and they destroy the yajna of the rishi. That's all they do. It's not like they come and murder and pillage. They just destroy the yajna. And you're like, that's not particularly offensive. Why do they keep doing that? So Arsha was the one who actually explained, and she spoke about this entire concept of Rita, or this cosmic order, and how the yajna is what kind of maintains Rita or the cosmic order. So what happens is when the asuras and rakshasas and the evil forces, when they destroy the yajna, what they do is they pollute the Rita and destabilize cosmic order. And cosmic order is what is needed for, the correct cycle of seasons and all good things happen because of cosmic order. So I love that explanation of the fact that now why would the asuras and rakshasas destroy cosmic order? I mean, destroy the yajnas. So when I started working on this, I knew that I wanted an element of magic. And that's when I thought that, okay, what if instead of cosmic order, I use the concept of magic? And I say that magic is what it's the yajnas or these sacrificial fires that sustain magic. And when these fires are affected, magic dips. And magic is what sustains the kind of, these places. It allows you to, it's a kind of technology enabler in that sense. So I just thought that, it might be good to use magic as an not just a device, but almost as a character in the story. And what the bad guys do, what the asuras and the rakshasas do to destabilize Kosala by destroying the magic and the sacrificial fires and all of that. So I think I kind of borrowed those core ideas of the yajna and why the asuras and rakshasas destroy that, and brought in magic to kind of contemporize the whole thing. So yeah, that's really what it was.
Yeah, no, and I'm really glad that you brought up Arshia Sattar actually, because I wanted to, just to contextualize it, there are two kinds of writers who, when they attempt to write or rewrite mythology. So there's one kind like Arshia Sattar, who is known as a scholar of, the Ramayana, and what she does is she stays as true to the text as possible, right? Because it's a literal translation. Whereas on the other hand, we have writers like you who are also known as alternate mythology writers, who then sort of take this creative liberty and reimagine the story, which is what I think really fascinates me, because I think, you know, there's a whole world of stories out there right now, right? There's like a boom. You have, you know, stories on OTT, you have movies, you have books everywhere. So, you know, for example, when we talk about films, there was Adipurush, you know, which a lot of people didn't like for how modern or how sort of controversial those dialogues were. And, you know, what we also saw was recently on an OTT platform, there was a Tamil film, Annapurani, you know, which was recently banned because it sort of showed, I think, Sita and Ram, who were, they were eating non-veg food. So I think it's a very tricky space to be in, you know, because on one hand, we look at epics for their virtues, we sort of, you know, look up to them. And on the other hand, we're trying to reimagine them, you know. So, you know, as a creative process, is this something that crosses your mind when you approach these stories, even though we know you have fictionalized a lot of it, you know, like, for example, about being offensive, about staying true to the epic? What are the thoughts that, you know, come across, that you come across?
Yeah, this is, again, very valid, particularly in the times that we live in. It's a valid question and an even more valid concern, I think. Two things. One is, let's tackle the question of staying as true to the source material as possible. So I think there are two ways of looking at it. One is, I think every teller of mythology, whether it's Indian mythology, Persian, Greek, whatever, every teller has probably brought their own interpretation, their own value system, whatever you might call it, into their tellings. And you know, it could just be a context of time. So, for example, let's take the Ramayana for example. Today, when any popular narration of the Ramayana is bound to have the Lakshman Rekha sequence of Sita being in the hut and Lakshman drawing that, you know, that Lakshman Rekha and telling Sita not to step out. We all acknowledge that Valmiki's Ramayana is the Adikavya, which means technically the Uber text. Valmiki's Ramayana does not have the Lakshman Rekha. The Lakshman Rekha, it was created at a much later date, probably by Tulsidas, which already tells you that a writer took creative license and brought in fictionalization. Assuming that the original was not fictional. Assuming the original was not fictional, there is a writer, a teller, who has already started fictionalizing a telling. So I think what happens is that I've had arguments with quite a few purist mythologists who have kind of told me in no uncertain terms that I probably do, me and people like me, we do mythology a disservice by telling false mythologies. And I found that a little strange because I thought all mythologies were supposed to be pieces of fiction. But let's not go there. But my point is that the moment we allow one person to fictionalize and we accept it, then I think we've opened the door for any amount of fictionalization and reinterpretation. So I'm not averse to fictionalizing mythology as long as we understand why we are doing it. So for example, in my case, it's actually not the story of the Ramayana at all. I'm not even touching the Ramayana. I'm not even going to where Lakshman and Sita and Rama. So I'm actually telling a story which has never been told in that sense. To answer the second part of your question about, you know, what we should be careful about, how does one, you know, step on eggshells in that sense? I think given the times we are in, and I think it's not just the times we are in, at any point in time, it just needs two people to be angry. And that's all you need. You need to piss off just two people. I think the important thing is, what are we saying? So I think as a storyteller, I'm mindful of the sensitivity of content. I'm aware of the kind of sensibilities that people have. And my intent with the Bharat series has not been to be confrontational. So what I do is, my Bharat at the end of the day is still loyal to Ram. My Bharat at the end of the day is still waiting for the 14 years of exile to get over, so that Ram can come and become king. My Bharat still insists that it's Ram's place and not mine. So the Padukas are on the throne and not me. So I think in that sense, I'm playing in a zone which is perfectly safe, because my telling does not offend anyone. The intent is not to offend anyone. And I think one of the fundamental questions would be, for example, KK. In my story, she does come across as unrepentant. She comes across as a very powerful character. But I think her questions are valid. Especially her questions, the way she questions her husband. I think there's a line from, I think, the first book where, you know, when Bharat tells her that, you know, you picked me, and she says that, you know, I have only one son. Dashrath had four and still he picked only one. And I think that's a very valid way of looking at KK. And I think it's important to understand these characters and where they're coming from. So the idea is not to offend, but again, who takes offense where, when? It's not really something that we have complete control over. So we can just hope, write and hope for the best, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. would you ever consider playing in an unsafe zone?
It's a very interesting question, and yes, I might, as long as I find a subject that is exciting enough, or a character, or a character or a subject that's fascinating and enough, and I feel passionately about. Yeah, why not? Yeah, definitely, why not? So, for example, a character like Ghatotkach for me would be a very fascinating hero to look at, because again, he's not traditionally look, he's the son of Bheem and a Rakshasi. He's not really pure blood in that sense. So he's not a pure-blooded hero. It would be interesting to look at Ghatotkach's story in terms of who he is, and look at how he's been kind of marginalized in the telling of the story, because what he does is actually quite epic in the Mahabharata. But somewhere along the way, nobody really cares about that guy. I would be, as long as I feel passionately about it, yes, why not? I mean, yeah, I would, of course, need to be a little careful given where I am, but.
Yeah, that's really good to know, and it reminds me, I saw a play I think last year about Shikhandi, who is a trans character in the Mahabharata, and it was just absolutely fabulous to see them given that kind of representation and these sort of unknown characters or characters that aren't given that much bhav actually have a whole play and books around them. So it's because I love mythology. We all, I think, have grown up as living in India, watching it on TV, watching the movies, reading Amar Chitra Katha. So there's an unending appetite for mythology in India. And what I really liked about your book is the relationship dynamics. And you already illuminated for us, the relationship dynamic between Bharat and his mother, Kaikeyi, and the complicated relationship. Then there's the relationship between Bharat and Urmila, who is Lakshman's wife, and she is, hesitant. Bharat is hesitant to face her because, she's been left behind by Lakshman, and nobody ever talks about that either. And it's because of Kaikeyi's wishes. And then there's this relationship with the father-in-law. So out of all these dynamics, apart from the one that we already spoken about with Bharat and his mother, which was your favorite to explore, and did it change in any way your view on relationships?
Yes, I think for me, I think when I first read that Bharat had a maternal uncle, and Yudhijit is actually is supposed to have been Kekki's brother, I immediately decided that, because again, as I said, Bharat had not grown up in Ayodhya. He'd spent most of his childhood and adolescence in Kekkiya. So I just assumed that his maternal uncle would have had a lot of role to play in shaping who Bharat is. And I thought it would be interesting for Bharat and Yudhijit to almost have a, they're not really father and son in that sense, but they're both father and son and also elder brother and younger brother. So Yudhijit in many ways is the father and elder brother that Bharat never had. So he's a composite of Dashrath and Ram minus the nimbus or the halo around them. So I thought Yudhijit was a very interesting character, and using Bharat's his adolescence and his growing years and his association with Yudhijit, I thought that was a very interesting story to tell. I also love the relationship that Bharat has with the stabler, Siripala, who's this kind of his father's loyal bodyguard who's now an old man. And Bharat has always kind of found validation through this old man, because Bharat is a great horseman, and so he keeps talking about how Bharat is a great horseman. And so again, Siripala is a kind of father figure that Bharat never had. So I think I've been kind of, I've found it very fascinating that in the absence of Dashrath's holding hand or guiding hand or whatever it might be, who does Bharat turn to as a father figure? And I instinctively believe that it would probably have been Yudhijit in the early years. And later, particularly during the course of the book, the timeline of the book, it's Siripala. Because whenever Bharat is going through a bad phase, he usually lands up with Siripala. And it also helps that the dog is there. And yeah, because I love dogs, so the dog is there. So but I think these were relationships that I was quite I liked exploring, and and Bharat and Mandavi too, for that matter. You know, I think it's a very interesting story because, again, nobody really talks about Mandavi, nobody talks about Urmila, nobody talks about, Shrutakirti, who was Shatrughna's wife. So I thought it would be interesting to look at what role Mandavi would have. And I realized that probably Mandavi is the kind of, she gives Bharat the kind of stability that he needs, emotional, she's his kind of emotional anchor. And I think she does play that role in a very limited sort of way so far. Let's see how it kind of progresses in book three. But these are characters I've kind of loved exploring, relationships I've loved exploring. So that's where we are.
Yeah, no, I think these fictional relationships that you built, it sort of made me very curious, about your own family dynamics. So for example, even the fact that we all grew up with these stories. Like, the first time, I think for me, one of the stories that really stood out in my childhood was the fact, I think, that Eklavya, right, who wanted to learn archery, and he's so dedicated towards his art that he actually cuts his thumb as a Guru Dakshina. And that's something that was sort of my entry point to this. I'm really curious to know, what was that entry point for you? Like, sort of, for some of us, it could be grandparents narrating stories, it could be reading books. So could you please share maybe one instance of probably, a dynamic that you've experienced with your family member in relation to these, myths?
So I think going back, it obviously goes back to childhood, and I think it's my mother, who was with us still about a month ago. She's had a big role to play in my love for stories. So she used to always, she had a story for everything virtually. Most mothers do actually in that way, but she had a story for everything. And my early introduction to Indian mythology was through her. So she would tell me stories from the Ramayana or the Mahabharata, and there would be, or some Purana, some small story somewhere. It would never be one large overarching story. But I think as I grew older, it was Amar Chitra Katha which definitely opened the doors to mythology. I remember some one of the earliest mythological books that I had read was probably Harishchandra. Raja Harishchandra was probably one of the earliest ones, and it's a deeply tragic story. I remember being affected by it quite badly because I felt so bad for the man, and how the gods test him, and why would you test someone who's so nice and loyal to you? Anyway, that's a different story. But I think Amar Chitra Katha definitely brought that out. Amar Chitra Katha, Chanda Mama. When I was growing up, we had this magazine, this magazine called Chanda Mama. And in fact, my introduction to Vikramaditya, who's actually the hero in my Veergatha series, was through Chanda Mama. Vikram and Betal stories and all of that kind of stuff. So that's really where my love for mythology kind of took root. But I think there were two things, and at that really, that I fell in love with legend and mythology. One was the Tales of King Arthur. I had this book in Shillong, The Legends of King Arthur, and I remember reading King Arthur. And in many ways, actually, Vikramaditya Veergatha is hugely inspired by King Arthur because it's the story of a king and his council of nine. So it's like, King Arthur and his, the Knights of the Round Table and all of that. Of course, I think that's just the launching ground. After that, it's a completely different story. But King Arthur, I think, really opened my eyes to telling an epic tale, and that, oh wow, you could actually tell tales like this, which were not about gods. So till then, we were still, Ramayana, Mahabharata was all about gods. King Arthur was probably the first one that told me, wow, you could tell an epic tale about a human being. I hadn't read the Greek, whether it was, Jason or, Odysseus. I hadn't read those yet at that point in time. But King Arthur was one. And then there was this book called, I think it was called The Legends of Ancient Persia. It was all about Rustam and Sohrab and Iskandar and Zal the White-Haired and all of that stuff. So that's really when my fascination for mythology, and it was mythology that I had not been exposed to. So Persian mythology was so different from, our mythology, but at the same time, so many interesting points of intersection. So that's really where my love for mythology kind of took root. And I've always loved fantasy as a genre, whether it's Tolkien or whether it's, I love horror, I love fantasy. These are favorite genres. So I think that's what made me sit down and write Veergatha and Warlord, because there's a lot of fantasy elements that actually I weave into this, into mythology. Not that our mythology doesn't have fantasy, but I just kind of consciously, pack in more and more fantasy elements into it because I think, yeah, it's just cool. That's why.
Yeah, I think also there's also a growing appetite for merging the fantasy elements with mythology. Like movies are coming out, Brahmastra, all of those things. Because I think we're getting more exposed to fantasy as a genre, whereas it wasn't so prevalent earlier before, especially with OTT movies, all of that. So people are really enjoying that as well. And what about sort of like books that like current books that on mythology or fantasy that you would recommend?
Fantasy mythology, I haven't read pure mythology in a while. So, but fantasy,
Alternative
yes.
mythology.
Actually, okay. Let me first talk about fantasy because I've been reading quite a bit of fantasy of late. So there's this fantastic series by Joe Abercrombie, the first Blade. No, the Blade itself. Oh, I'm sorry. I'll get back to you on it. But it's a series by Joe Abercrombie. That's a great series. I've been reading the series by Scott Lynch, The Lies of Locke Lamora, which is a fascinating. Sorry, the first book is called The Lies of Locke Lamora. Series is called The Gentleman Bastards, I think. That's what they're called. So it's a great series of books. So that's something in fantasy that of late I've been reading. I've been reading some modern fantasy. So there's this author called Paolo Bacigalupi, this American guy. He writes kind of they're fantasies, but set in a kind of futuristic space. So it's not sci-fi really. It's closer to if you've heard of China Mayville, it's closer to China Mayville kind of writing. So yeah, so there's some of the interesting fantasy stuff that I've been reading. Alternate mythology, I don't know how much of. I think most of it, what we are doing right now in India is basically telling mythology the way it was, but just kind of telling it in a more exciting way, probably. It all goes back to, I think, what Ashok Bankar started with the Prince of Ayodhya series. I really think that Ashok Bankar was the one who kind of started this movement in retelling mythology in a cooler way for today's audiences. And again, I let me the caveat is retelling mythology in English, because I think we've always been telling mythological stories and retelling mythological stories in the languages, whether it's Marathi, Telugu, Kannada, Malayalam, Bengali, whatever it is. It's only in English that we've been seeing this since Ashok Banker started that. And of course, Amish was phenomenal with his Shiva trilogy. So I think again, I don't know how much of it is really alternate in that sense, because a lot of it, but I guess, yeah, they are, because they do kind of take what we know and kind of build on it in that sense. So,
Yeah.
yeah, so there is, yeah, I don't think I can take the mantle of being the only one who does
But do you know, but
that.
what you're saying is right. It is something new that you've done, because it is usually what happens is, yeah, they make it more exciting, but this is sort of merging the fantasy element with the mythology, which is quite interesting.
Yeah, and in fact, like we interviewed Ashok Banker, for the fact that his book focused on love lessons in the Mahabharata, right? When people talk about the Mahabharata, they talk about war, they talk about all of this, but nobody talks about love, right? And that was actually our Valentine's Day session, so it was a lot of fun, So if we talk about, I would say this either fantasy or mythology, right? What keeps us going, according to me, is the action-packed scenes, right? I mean, every scene has to have action. There's, we weapons, there's someone fighting, someone defending, all of that. So for me, in fact, I think, one of the most interesting scenes is when Bharat sort of defends himself. And you've mentioned this where you said that, it was the sixth sense which sort of, saved Bharat. There was this point where I think what you call it is a shurika. A dagger which comes in, it's basically aimed for the back of his head, and what he does is he sort of counter uses a spell to counter that, and it's very interesting, that whole scene of this battle. So I wanted to know for you, because you've written almost like three books now on this, out of all, which was the most entertaining scene for you to write, sort of like which mixes emotion, which mixes action, and sort of everything in it.
So yeah, actually, I have a particular reader in he's in Pune. So he was actually quite disappointed with the second book, because he was expecting large scale epic battles, and I'll tell you why. Because if action is what readers like in fantasy, actually my Veergatha series, the four books, it is just packed with action and fantasy. There's just so much of action. There are war sequences, battle sequences that last 5 pages, 6 pages. Multiple points of view, camera angles, all kind of nonsense I do. Okay, and readers who like action, they completely love that series. It's so that's really where I've actually explored action the most. And again, like the kind of, beasts and, monsters that exist in that series, I still haven't even got there in this series. In fact, in many ways, very intentionally, because I'd already done all that with Veergatha. I'd got epic scale battles, epic scale monsters. So I didn't want to kind of repeat myself and end up doing the same thing here. So I think the battles in the Warlord series are a little smaller in scale, nowhere as close to what is there in Veergatha. But having said that, yes, I know that, the final epic battle in Warlord is a big set piece action. It's very clear in my head, and I'm really very excited about the idea. I really still don't know how I'm going to do it, because it's extremely fascinating, because it ties in two very, very interesting things in the Ramayana, but never connected before. So and I'm like very, very excited about doing this. I remember when I got this idea, I was like, wow. And I went and told my wife, and I think I've got the final sequence. I've got, this is what it is. And she said, how are you going to do it? I said, I have no idea how to do it, but hopefully I'll get there by the end. So yeah, by the end of this year,
Right.
I should have finished that. But the action sequences that I have enjoyed doing the most, I think more in the Veergatha series, because as I said, those have been the larger set piece action sequences. We haven't really got really big action sequences yet in the Warlord series. But yeah, I think what I like about action is that, as you said, if you like action, it's very visual. How do you make that action visual? In terms of when you write it out. See, when I also write for web shows and movies. So when people ask me what's the difference between writing a book and writing a manuscript, a script, a screenplay, I keep telling them that, like the manuscript, the screenplay is basically the starting point of the journey. I mean, it's basically it's the blueprint. The manuscript or the book is the finished final product. So that's how different they are, right? One is just a roadmap, the other is the whole, scenery, landscape, all of that. So when you write a book, I am the cinematographer, I am the special effects guy, I am the cameraman, I'm whatever, I have to be everything. So writing those action scenes is great fun, because you've got to kind of describe it in such a way that it totally comes alive for the reader and they can see the whole thing, where what is happening, all those kind of stuff. Yeah, so it's good fun. I enjoy doing that stuff. It's also exhausting, because after some time you realize that, at the end of the day, two people fighting with a sword, how many different ways can you describe that? Right? So I think, yeah, so the challenge is to figure out either new weapons or new monsters or new magical powers or whatever it is. Because yeah, I really wonder sometimes, those guys who used to write those westerns, whether it was, Louis L'Amour or whoever, how did they write those gunfights? Because at the end of the day, the gunfight is a gunfight. You draw the gun and you shoot and one guy dies. So how do you dramatize it? I think that's really the beauty of writing and the joy of it.
Yeah, no, I think I really relate to this, Shenjen. Just seeing your excitement of, sort of like waiting to write the scene which has the most action is really, really interesting. I call it the Eureka moment. Like even for me, for example, like if there's a story in my head, okay, and for me, it happens to me at the most unexpected time. So the other day, I was on the beach, just enjoying the view and all of that, and all of a sudden, I realized, oh, this is how I can actually tie it up, and that's when you realize you don't have anything with you to sort of capture that. It's that moment, but I think it's one of the most exciting moments a writer can have. So we, Tara and I, are definitely looking forward to reading that scene, Shatrajit. It definitely, I'm sure it's something that will be unique, as you said, because it hasn't been, those two dots haven't been connected before. Yeah.
Very, very quickly, I must tell you this, a
Yes.
small aside. So the Vikramaditya Veergatha series, like when it had been pitched, it was pitched as a trilogy, but then it ended up being four books, because by the time I reached the end of the second book, I realized that I've got so much of story left, I can't do it in one book, so it became four books. So when it had been pitched, I was very excited, and this is in 2013. I had been very excited, and I loved the setup, all of that, and my publisher loved it, everything was great. So my publisher told me how this is going to end. And today I can be honest, I had three potential endings, but very honestly, I was not excited with any of them. But I told him, yeah, sorted, sorted. I've got the ending. Don't worry. It's all good. First book is out. Second book is out. Third book is out. I'm still not happy. And now my fourth book. This is the last book. It ends. I'm still not happy with my ending. I'm like, okay, I'll pick the best of the three, but I know that they're just okay endings. I'm not going into spoiler territory, but for various reasons. But it so happened that I was at a writing retreat, and I was like, I really needed a break from home. So I was in Alibag at a retreat, and I was alone for 28 days. And one evening, I'd started writing the fourth book, and I'm so unhappy with the ending. I realized something. I see a ray of light, violins, ray of light, angels, all that stuff happens. And I'm like, oh, wow. I think it through for about an hour. And then I called my wife, who was in Mumbai. I called her and I told her that, look, how about this as an ending? She's an editor and all, so she's kind of familiar with the storytelling world. She thought about it and she said, I think this is definitely the best of what we've got, and I think it's perfect. So I said, let's sleep on it and see. The next day morning, I woke up and I was as excited about it. And that's actually the ending that we've got now. But the truth is that that came in the seventh year of my writing. So at one level, I'm almost like, oh God, what if I had not got that? Yeah, so that fear is always there. Thankfully, with Warlord, that's not there. With Warlord, I know how it's going to end. I mean, so we know how it's going to end. It's obviously going to end with Ram coming back, and that because the Ramayana. But the whole point is, what is that big climactic moment that so that's really what it is. So yeah.
And I was going to ask you that, do you sort of plot, because you're a trilogy and series writer, do you plot it all in advance, or are there some things that, which you've answered, are there some things that come later on? Because it's a lot. I mean, like, over so many years to keep writing, I think of J.K. Rowling and how, like, their photos of, like, the notes and the character sketches and all of that, and keep all of that in your head, must be quite a lot.
It is, yes, because particularly true in Veergatha, even true in Warlord, but more true in Veergatha, there are things that happen in book one. Those are the plants, and the payoffs are visible only in book four. So you don't even realize that, that plant was there in book one so that it could make sense in book four. So for readers, it's a great, like, it's really great for readers because you realize, oh, you know what? I had read this 6 years ago. Now this is how this finally, this is where this piece falls into the puzzle, into the jigsaw puzzle. So I think those plants and payoffs are very important. It could be plot points, it could be character graphs, it could be motives, whatever it is. Yes, even in Warlord, there are a couple of things that are there. Yeah, hopefully we'll get there and
We'll see.
we'll get them land them right.
Yes. No, I feel, yeah, like sometimes loose ends, they don't make sense, but when you obviously read the series, they will start to make sense. Okay, so then this brings us to the second last round of the interview, which is a fun quiz. Okay. I will be giving you three options. You have to pick one. Okay, which you think is the most fun. Okay. If you could act in a play, which role would you pick? A, Dashrath, B, Ram, C, Bharat.
Dashrath.
Okay, interesting. If you could act as a female from an epic, which would you pick? A, Kekei, B, Mantara, whose Kekei is maid and who actually, poisons her wine. C, Urmila, who's Lakshman's wife.
Kiki.
Nice. Okay. If you could be one conflict that comes in the way of Bharat just to test his strength, what would you be? A, the Rakshasa, B, Ravan, C, the epidemic that makes people go missing.
Ravan, because
Okay.
ultimately he's the one who's pulling all the strings. So,
Yes. Okay. All right. So this brings us to the last round of the interview. It is our rapid fire round. And as the name suggests, Chatrajit, you have to be rapid. You can only answer in one word or one sentence. Okay. No thinking allowed. One character from the Ramayana that you think is overrated.
overrated.
No thinking. Time's
No
up.
thinking. Okay. Dashrath.
Okay. One character from the Ramayana you would love to have lunch with.
Kumbhakaran.
Oh, I think that would be my answer too. Okay, where do you
Maybe
rank?
he'll have me for lunch.
Yeah, that's a good one. Okay, where do you write?
On my bed.
One way to cope with writing deadlines.
Ignore them.
Nice. Okay, what's next? That is apart from the third book in the series.
A contemporary dark psychological thriller
Oh, wow. Okay.
with a woman at its core, because that's one thing that I've not done so far. And I'm
Wow.
very clear, I know what the story is. So yeah, that's what
Amazing.
I'm gonna do.
We just interviewed two psychological thriller authors.
Yes.
Very fascinating to get into their
Yeah, and
psyches.
very similar with very strong female leads.
Female,
I think
yeah.
this is something we're really
Who's this?
it was Nidhi Upadhyay and Devashish Sardana. You should check out the book.
Okay, I will check them out. Is it is the is the is the podcast live?
Yes.
Okay, I'll check it out after this. I'll do that.
Yeah.
Great. Yeah.
Okay, that brings us to the end of this interview. Thank you so much. I think we've learned a lot about how to merge fantasy with mythology, about Bharat, and about your process. So thank you so much. It was really very interesting.
Thank you so much, Tara and Michelle. Yeah, it was an absolute pleasure being here, talking to you guys, talking about what I love doing the most, talking about having left a life behind and embraced a new one. So yeah, thanks for the opportunity. And yeah, God bless both of you.
Hope you enjoyed this episode of Books and Beyond with Bound.
This podcast is created by Bound, a company that helps you grow through story. Find us at Bound India on all social media platforms.
Tune in every Wednesday as we peek into the lives and minds of some brilliant authors from India and South Asia.